Welcome to Technology and Security. TS is a podcast exploring the intersections of emerging technologies and national security. I'm your host, Dr. Mia Hamandari.
My guest today is Nina Jankowicz. Nina is a disinformation expert who advocates for those harassed online. She's the vice president of the Center for Information Resilience. In 2022, she served as the executive director of the Disinformation Governance Board in the U.S. Department of Homeland Security. She has authored two fabulous books, How to Lose the Information War and How to Be a Woman Online. Thanks so much for joining me, Nina.
I'm really excited to be here.
We're coming to you today from the lands of the Dharawal people. We pay our respects to their elders, past, present and emerging. We acknowledge their continuing connection to land, sea and community and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. Nina, you have written extensively about elections and the information environment, and we've both written about the significance of 2024 for elections. 76 countries are holding elections this year, which will see more than half the world's population casting a ballot. What are you most concerned about?
I think the thing that makes me most worried is actually the change, kind of sea change, in how we think about content moderation and trust and safety as we head into this year. Back in 2016, 2017, this was a field that didn't really exist yet. Since then, we've seen kind of the emergence of the field, the emergence of a lot of cooperation between the public and private sectors to identify and mitigate disinformation that have resulted in some pretty big gains, right? We've seen, you know, campaigns taken down by the French government that the Russians were trying to interfere in the 2017 French presidential election. We've seen, of course, the Iranian interference in 2020, where Iranians were pretending to be Proud Boys in the U.S. election and targeting Democratic voters in swing states in order to try to suppress their voter turnout. And all of that was a result of coordination between the public and private sectors, and had less of an effect than it might have otherwise if we didn't have that coordination. And now what we see, especially here in the U.S., is this equivalence between any content moderation and censorship. And so while we head into this critical election period, I'm just worried that we're not going to see as much attention that is leading to actual change and mitigation of threats that we saw in previous election cycles. And I'm also worried that we're not going to see as much robust research into this sphere because, in addition to all of that, we're also seeing harassment campaigns against individual researchers and their research institutions. And we have a large section of the population, at least here in the United States, that is equating not only keeping our democracy safe, but keeping people safe online as censorship.
In your recent Foreign Affairs article, you said nearly 8 years after Russian operatives attempted to interfere in the 2016 U.S. presidential election, U.S. democracy has become even less safe and the country's information environment more polluted, with the freedom of speech of U.S. citizens more at risk. What do you think needs to be done about it?
I mean, I think we're in such an intractable place here in the United States right now where, again, we've seen these threats laid out over and over, and yet we've done so little about it. And so I think the first order of business is like, yeah, let's have these conversations about what is the proper relationship between government and the social media platforms. What oversight should the social media platforms have? And so what I would like to see is a not even a regulatory regime, but a transparency and oversight regime over the social media platforms, so we understand the decisions that they're making, what they're moderating, why they're moderating it, how much they're responding to user reports of harassment and threats and things like this. Are they upholding their duty of care to their users? And are they allowing users kind of right to appeal and things like that? And from there, with that information in hand, we can actually start to have the regulatory conversation that has been happening in fits and starts over the past 8 years, but really hasn't gotten anywhere. And frankly, it's going to continue to affect our national security and affect the freedom of speech of millions of people, not only Americans, but around the world, while we continue to drag our feet as the home of many of the social media companies in letting them continue to self-regulate.
Can you describe what you see as the security threats of disinformation?
Yeah, I mean, so in my research, the things that have been the most shocking to me are the times when our adversaries are able to actually affect real world behavior. So to me, it's not about the ads that the Russians bought in 2016, and it's not about bots and trolls. It is about real world behavior and the way that Russia is able, well, not just Russia, but that's my area of expertise, right? Russia is able to change that. What people seem to misunderstand, particularly about foreign disinformation, it's not just about silly words on the internet or like memes that are being targeted from the Internet Research Agency. It's about changing behavior. It's about participation in our democracy and everybody maintaining kind of their own free will. And so when I hear people say, oh, I don't really care if Russia's interfering in our democracy, I mean, that's kind of chilling to me. I care. I care if any foreign nation is trying to unduly influence what American or Australian or EU voters are thinking and doing. There are greater national security threats as well to the decision making that is happening in our capitals. And so one clear way that that's playing out right now, of course, is Ukraine aid. We have this enormous contingent of Republicans who, fed in part by Russian disinformation about Ukraine, that is sitting on this aid while our Ukrainian allies are literally running out of bullets in the trenches that they're in. And if Ukraine is to fall, that opens the door not only for Russia to further explore what it sees as its near abroad in the former communist space, but it opens the door to China to do the same in Taiwan. It opens the door for many actors in the Middle East to start to instigate these unilateral changes of internationally recognized borders. And that does not lead to a secure or prosperous or peaceful world.
Do you see any technology solutions that might help us to be cognitively resilient or improve our infrastructure or nudge us towards making better content and dissemination choices?
Yeah, so there's been a lot of attempts at this with kind of, you know, the disinformation of yesteryear. And I think it's worked a little bit less well than some people had hoped. Where I am a little bit more optimistic is watermarking and the types of technologies that will allow us to identify deepfakes and manipulated video and images from the real stuff. And so we have seen over the past 7 years or so, a lot of efforts from industry, actually led by industry, including companies like Adobe and its Content Authenticity Initiative, which are pioneering what's called this watermark, a digital watermark that would allow people to trust the images that they're seeing or understand the ways in which they've been edited, if they have been edited. It's, I think, probably the best solution that we have. So I think that's a really good technological solution. And one of the reasons that I'm less worried about really hyper photorealistic deepfakes making such an impact on our discourse. I think when it comes to text-based deepfakes, so large language models and generative AI there, we're in a little bit more hot water. But with the images, I'm actually pretty optimistic. And I think that's a digital tool that's going to be pretty widespread in the future as deepfakes become more accessible and democratized.
And how can we improve what I think is necessary investment in the trust and safety functions?
Yeah, so the trust and safety folks are kind of a bit of a unicorn, especially now because many of them have been let go from various tech companies. But they kind of cropped up in the post-2016 era, not only looking at things like foreign interference, but also looking at, things like hate speech and harassment online, looking at child sexual abuse material, looking at violent content, and making sure that the things that were prohibited by community standards or terms of service were not making their way into people's feeds. Twitter, before Elon Musk's acquisition, there were a couple of things that the trust and safety team did there, kind of policy-wise, that were interesting. They, of course, were behind the release of many of the transparency reports related, or all of the transparency reports related to foreign interference. So Twitter, unlike any other platform, would put out a data set, just a massive CSV file, of all the foreign takedowns that they did for researchers to play around in, like a giant sandbox. And that was great, right? We gained so much understanding of the types of activity that they were seeing online with that. They also introduced the infamous, have you read the article pop-up before you retweet it, right? And that actually showed, they did some research on it, and it showed that like that interstitial popping up before people retweeted things would actually stop them retweeting it by 20%. And that's a great way to kind of put the brakes on disinformation. Similarly, with hate speech, they introduced a pop-up. Again, that again slowed down uncivil behavior on Twitter by a bit. So they were kind of at the head of things. At Facebook currently and Instagram, AI is doing a lot of the content moderation decisions for them. So I would say trust and safety folks are the people who craft the policy. They're the ones that kind of research and implement it. And then you've got kind of your content moderators below that, if that helps people visualize how they exist within a company. And, you know, I think they're a really critical function because they're thinking about the user experience on the platform and actually thinking about protecting people.
The U.S. has a really specific challenge in the information environment. And I'm talking here about the First Amendment, of course. I'm really interested to hear your thoughts on how to manage polarization and preserve the notion of free speech at the same time protecting vulnerable people, especially minorities, and reducing hate crimes.
This is something I've thought about a lot. I've dealt with a pretty significant amount of harassment myself. And what I've found is that the legal infrastructure in the United States for protection against some of the nastiest stuff you'll find on the internet, including cyberstalking and just direct violent threats, does not exist in the United States. I have a cyberstalker myself, and I had to use a provision under Virginia law that is basically, it exists for victims of domestic abuse and violence. And that's how I had to kind of bring up a protective order so that this man could not show up outside my home or at my place of work or at events that I do and harass me. And I think that that is just such a, again, these laws are not fit for purpose. Words online do have an effect offline, particularly for women and minority communities. Often our families are brought into it. Often these are, I would say, direct and credible threats in a country that unfortunately has the level of gun ownership and the level of kind of extremism that we do right now. I think we have to rightfully take all of those threats pretty seriously. So I'm hoping that we see an expansion of those codes, particularly for things like deepfake pornography. That's an easy win, right? But some of the thornier issues, if the people who said these things to me online were saying them to me in my face over and over, it would be a no-brainer. I would be able to get a protective order against them very easily. But just because they're behind a keyboard several states away, I'm meant to feel less safe, even though I've been doxxed, even though I've been directly threatened, even though I've been, you know, depicted in deepfake pornography. I'm just supposed to be okay with that because they're behind a keyboard. And yet we've seen this direct pathway of radicalization to violence from people who have started on the internet and then ended up shooting up pizza parlors or worse. So I think we need to reckon with that. And I don't think it's going to be an easy battle because when I started promoting my second book on how to be a woman online, this kind of free speech absolutist ideology about how we spoke on the internet just didn't jive with actual free speech protections for women and minorities. If these folks who are using violent rhetoric, who are using misogynist, racist rhetoric online, homophobic rhetoric, you name it, are allowed to shout loudly and incessantly at us, it means that these minority voices are going to silence themselves. And we've seen that happening. So I think we need to recognize that it's a balance, that free speech is not absolute, even in the United States. And I think one of the best ways to do that, in addition to adding some specific stipulations to our state and federal legal codes about things like cyberstalking and harassment, is to insist on more oversight over the platforms. The UK has just passed their online safety bill, and it's come into action. And I know there are a lot of very legitimate concerns about freedom of expression and encryption related to that bill. But I do think that when it comes to racism and the protection of women and girls and other hate speech, that it is hitting the mark. And what it does is make sure that the platforms are upholding their duty of care toward users. And it can fine the individual executives for not upholding that duty of care. I also, by the way, quite like the e-safety commissioner system in Australia.
Thank you for writing the book. We'll put a link in the show notes, but it was How to Be a Woman Online, Surviving Abuse and Harassment and How to Fight Back. How do you see that affecting women in public roles in 2024? I mean, even in Australia, we have these protections, and yet we're still seeing a much greater rate of online harassment and abuse.
I think, unfortunately, this misogyny has been normalized by politicians, by people in power, by influencers. And so when there's no consequence for the people at the top who are doing it, we see kind of an open door for anybody else to engage in it as well. And I think that's why we're seeing this increase. And I do think you're right that, you know, with that increase comes increased threat for not only women in public life, but I would say just kind of ordinary women as well. One of the things that I try to raise the alarm bell a lot about is deepfake pornography. Most of the deepfakes that exist today are non-consensual deepfake porn of women. About over 96% now. That statistic is old, from 2019.
You've written a lot about being a woman online. And so what was your response to the deepfakes of Taylor Swift?
I'm worried about deepfakes, right? Because I think they're becoming so democratized, so accessible. Almost anybody can create them. And when we think of those tools in the hands of our adversaries, is Russia more likely to create a deepfake faking nuclear war? Or are they more likely to create deepfake pornography of Kamala Harris or Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, or, you know, name your powerful woman official to undermine her and undermine kind of the robustness and equity in our democracy? I mean, I think that's much, much more likely, and frankly, technologically more possible, because these models are trained on women's bodies, and in a lot of that kind of modeling already exists, right? So I'm worried about that, and I'm worried just about the constant violence that women in our kind of public life have to face. I think there's such a reticence to call it what it is, that it is violence. But having experienced it myself and knowing kind of what you go through as a person in like your trauma response, your physical response when this stuff is happening to you, there's no other way to describe it, and it does have a lasting effect on you. Getting back to Taylor Swift, my hope with Taylor is that she will use the position of power that she's in, not just to kind of call attention to this with Congress or the tech companies, but to really bring together a community of deepfake survivors and use her power, her influence, and frankly, her many, many billions of dollars to potentially have a class action suit against the creators or distributors of these deepfakes. In large part, deepfake pornography on the internet exists on a couple of key websites that Google indexes. So again, potentially pressuring Google for de-indexing and demonetizing these sites, or potentially bringing a class action suit against the sites that store and amplify these deepfakes, with a bunch of the women, both notable and just ordinary women who have been depicted in deepfakes and had their lives upturned by them. I think that would be a really powerful message to show, you know, yes, we do need this federal level legislation that doesn't exist yet to for either civil or criminal penalties for deepfake porn. But also, when you bring women together and when you piss them off, they happen to be very powerful. So look out. Like, I think that is like a perfect thing for Taylor Swift to do.
I think this is definitely the first episode we've talked about Tay-Tay, so... I want to go to a segment here. What are some of the interdependencies and vulnerabilities of the information environment that you wish were better understood?
Oh, I was just talking to a group of college students today about cybersecurity and information security, right? And often we see the study of information environments or disinformation kind of lumped in under cyber. I think obviously they're two kind of distinct fields that often have connection. And I'm kind of shocked how little we speak each other's languages, right? It's pretty rare that we see people who are talking about like cyber resilience and information resilience in a way that is intertwined. And so I'd like to see more of that. I'd also like to see the demystification of both of these things as like highly technical subjects.
How and why are the intersections between data and the information environment important?
The way that these platforms are staying free is because they're trafficking in our data. And I think we need to understand the different data points that are being collected about us and the ways that they're used to target and manipulate us. And I think like understanding all of that and the way that targeting works, plus all the other data points that aren't based on your location, right? Your browsing history, your purchase history, All of the data points that unfortunately in the United States are really, really just out of control and sold to so many companies are used to create a very detailed picture of you online. So data is absolutely part of the influence game. And the more control we have over our personal data, the more in control of our information environment will be.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. This information environment looks worse than the one ahead of the 2016 election. What would a second Trump presidency mean for the United States information environment? And what would it mean for U.S. democracy?
I don't think I can understate the existential threat that Trump poses to democracy and the information environment. He's called the press the enemy of the people. He, of course, has absolutely no regard for facts. He has openly said he is going to kind of dismantle the civil service and attempt to prosecute against political enemies. He has mocked and questioned the utility of our most important alliances. I think, you know, not to mention the fact that he has endorsed violence in many cases through January 6th and other violent events, we'll be seeing kind of the propagandizing of our information environment even more than it already is. You know, Fox, Newsmax, OANN, a bunch of conservative influencers and online media outlets that work and live and breathe for the Trump presidency because it profits them. It's just a really scary state of affairs. And I, again, personally know very well what it means to be the person who is the villain of the week or the month or the year. Frankly, it was over a year for me that I still am sometimes mentioned on Fox News. And every time I am, it drives a huge wave of harassment toward me and my family, which is one of the reasons I'm suing Fox News for defamation. This is that power can't be understated. And it would be not only coming from these media networks, from Trump himself. And, you know, when you have the president doing that, it just magnifies it so many times over.
I think the thing that you've highlighted in that, though, which I've also seen in my own research, is that it is so easy to attack individuals and actually just remove them from the conversation, particularly women. And it does have a very chilling effect of removing those voices from the conversation. And I think that is a place in a democracy we don't want to be in. I'm going to pivot here to ask you some questions about Russia, because you are, of course, an expert in disinformation and Russia and Ukraine. Can you talk us through the intersections of Russian disinformation and some of the world events we're seeing?
Oof, yeah. I mean, anywhere Russia goes, there's a huge disinformation campaign following, right? So with the full-scale invasion of Ukraine, as we're recording this, we're just about 2 years from when the full-scale invasion began. I was leading some research at the Center for Information Resilience is continuing today, looking at open source verification and geolocation of incidents related to the war in Ukraine. And at the time, we were tracking the Russian troop buildup on the borders of Ukraine. And I remember having all these conversations with journalists and various government officials from around the world, not in the States, but especially some in Europe, who were just doubting that this was going to happen. And I said, I don't know how you can argue with, you know, hundreds of thousands of troops and all of this equipment being piled up at the border. We, a global community, were trusting the word of Vladimir Putin, who had lied so many, 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 many times before, trusting his assurances that these were just military exercises, to the point where they weren't believing what was in front of their eyes, the intel that the US and the UK had declassified, the open source evidence that was there. They wouldn't believe it until the last minute. And so I think that shows the strength of Russian disinformation. However, since then, I would say for the first year or so of the full-scale invasion, we saw pretty clear-eyed view coming from the international community about what Russia was up to and kind of a lack of tolerance for Russia's BS. And that was so refreshing. And I think that was in part because of the effort led by the US and UK to declassify evidence and pre-bunk some of the Russian narratives that were coming out. It was also because of the Ukrainian resilience and bravery and the communication strategy of the Zelensky administration that was like fully supported by a grassroots civil society effort that he embraced as well. As I mentioned before, you know, aid is sitting in Congress while congressmen twiddle their thumbs and Ukrainians are dying trying to keep their territory from Russia. So Russia has absolutely been pouring salt on that wound for the last year. They have absolutely exploited this pre-existing vulnerability in American society, and they're doing similar things in Europe. And then they've been very successful in the global majority countries, especially kind of Middle East, North Africa, Southeast Asia, where Ukraine is far away. And what they see is kind of U.S. or Western hypocrisy in support of Ukraine versus support of other democratic movements that have happened in other places around the world. Regarding Navalny's death, I think it's been interesting to see how Russian media have reacted to it. There's actually been a surprising amount of information related to Navalny's death. And I think the idea there is to make it seem like there is no foul play, to be as transparent as possible and say, oh, no, this guy just died. He was on a walk. It's OK. But obviously, when you put the full story together, right, of how Navalny has been treated throughout, you know, when he was still organizing in Russia, the fact that he was poisoned, and we know that again from open source investigations that Bellingcat conducted, as well as, you know, the various trials and tribulations that he's been through, he had gone through since he was imprisoned again in 2021. It just doesn't add up. And so unless you are predisposed to believing that life in a Russian work camp is great, and that Russia is great, you know, perhaps if you're Tucker Carlson, I think a lot of people are seeing through that as well. And we have just seen a raft of sanctions announced by the U.S. and a lot of European allies following suit. As one of my dear friends and a journalist who covers Ukraine, Sabra Ayres, said, everything that grows in Russia is either killed or dies. And I think that's a really clear-eyed view of Putin and his leadership.
You've written a fair bit, obviously, about Russian disinformation in Ukraine across an extended period of time. I was wondering if you can talk us through the shifts between the 2014 invasion of Crimea and the ongoing invasion of Ukraine, and some of the way that the information operations have changed tactically and become kind of more integrated with national strategy or grand strategy.
Absolutely. Yeah. So in 2014, I think we were seeing the auditioning of the tactics that we all became familiar with in the 2016 influence campaigns in the US and kind of Russian disinformation since then. So a lot of false amplifiers, trolls, bots commenting on news sites and message boards and Russian social media like Odnoklassniki and Vkontakte, which are kind of Russian versions of Facebook. We've seen a lot of a shift, I would say, both tactically and in terms of narratives since 2014. I think the sort of rote manipulation that used to exist is no longer going to fly on most social media platforms, even if it's in Russian or Ukrainian, which is a difference, right? At least that stuff still exists. They're able to detect that kind of bot activity or troll activity. The other difference, I think, is that it's much more top-down and less bottom-up than it used to be. So we used to have the IRA kind of posting away all their different little screeds and kind of throwing spaghetti at the wall and seeing what sticks. The stakes are higher now. It was a full-scale invasion with the intention of kind of decapitating the Ukrainian regime and taking over the entire country, not to mention the kind of war crimes and human rights abuses that have taken place by Russian soldiers. And so I think there is a lot more message discipline and a lot less of kind of the little hijinks that have occurred since then. We're seeing a lot coming from Russian diplomatic accounts, through Russian media, and through information laundering, identifying those useful idiots around the world who are willing to carry the flag for Putin and the Kremlin. That's really hard to push back against, right? It's not a fake account. It's somebody who's expressing their real opinion and moving that kind of across the world's information environment. And ultimately, you know, that plays into Putin's strategy of kind of reassembling the post-Soviet world together under one roof and pushing back against the expansion of NATO. That's all what this is about, right? And that narrative has carried through.
I've heard you say elsewhere and talk about countries that have succeeded in countering disinformation. Can you talk us through, you know, briefly some of those examples?
Yeah. So one of the ones that I, in earlier stages of my research, was incredibly kind of bullish on was Estonia. Obviously, Estonia had a quite large Russian population ethnically when Estonia became independent in 1991. And as a result of various government policies, they essentially de facto segregated that population. And it led to a lot of misgivings among them that Russia itself was able to kind of wheedle and make a lot worse. Estonia kind of got the memo that they needed to work on integrating the Russian population. And so they opened up a lot of opportunities for them. They started investing more in kind of Russian neighborhoods and Russian cities in the country. They really tried to up Estonian language learning, not in kind of the forceful way that they used to, but by opening classes that were free for Russians to get to. They invested in Russian language media, and they invested in kind of education and media literacy as well. And what they've seen is that kind of younger generations of ethnic Russians in Estonia are having more of an affinity toward Europe and more of an affinity toward Estonia than they are toward kind of Russia and the Russian Federation, even though they live in a kind of Russian-speaking enclave in Estonia. So I think that's one really great example. I'm not saying it's like fully solved, but to really mitigate a problem that was a sore for the Estonian government for a long time. I go into much more detail in my book. I look at a lot of the media literacy efforts across Central and Eastern Europe and the Nordics and Baltics as well. And I see a lot of promise. Ukraine has been really successful in its information and media literacy. I think that this is always part of the solution. I think it is so important. It really can't be overstated. And we've talked about some of the kind of algorithmic literacy that we need already today. It is teaching people to navigate their information environment helps with so many of the other kind of questions that we've discussed today. And frankly, keeps people safer, too. One of the things I've talked about in testimonies before Congress is the need to train troops and families of deployed troops who are frankly quite big targets of disinformation campaigns. And this is one of the ways that we can kind of test out information media literacy curriculum in the future. So a lot of those countries have done really well with that. And I think it needs to be the part of any solution toward disinformation that we have. It's not about what telling people what's true or false. It's just giving them the tools to navigate an increasingly complex information environment.
When you look at the average usage across devices per day, the West is spending a lot of time online. Can you talk me through what you see the relationship between attention capture and a changing information environment?
Oh, man, it's so crazy the way that our devices have kept us from like the long-term engagement with paper books. Like, I'm rereading Václav Havel's Power of the Powerless. This is a tiny book, right? It's tiny. And it's amazing how I struggle to kind of keep my attention on it. And I think that that also means that we are just drawn to the kind of most salacious headlines. We're drawn to the most clickbaity material, the stuff that autoplays, the stuff that captures our attention, instead of engaging with nuance. And when we lose that nuance and we have that context collapse, that is so much of the reason that disinformation finds fodder among vulnerable people these days.
You briefly served as the executive director of the Disinformation Governance Board in the U.S. Department of Homeland Security. The work was unfortunately disbanded after itself becoming the subject of a disinformation campaign. Do you have any reflections from a systemic change perspective, but also personally on that time?
Oh, I have lots of reflections, but we don't have a ton of time, so let me keep it top level. The biggest thing that I think governments need to be aware of when they are engaging in any counter disinformation work is that they need to be super transparent and proactive about communicating about those efforts, and that people are going to have legitimate questions and they need to be ready to answer them. They also need to be ready to very unequivocally and forcefully dispel with any allegations that are untrue. And that's what the Biden administration didn't do in my case. Nor did they support me kind of on a personal, physical, emotional security level. And these sorts of attacks, which are going to become increasingly personalized, they're not uncommon right now, and they're only going to become more common. And so what do governments do to support their people particularly the women and people of color, when it comes to these personal attacks. And that was the reason I left, was the fact that the Biden administration was absolutely deer in the headlights, had no idea what to do, not only about the false descriptions of the board, but about the personal attacks on me. They couldn't stick their neck out and say, actually, we hired Nina because she's one of the preeminent experts in this stuff. And here's her nonpartisan body of work that you are absolutely blowing out of proportion. They just couldn't find it in themselves to do that. And not to mention kind of the physical and IT security bits that they just absolutely were scrambling with. So I think we need to think proactively both on the comms front and the security front when engaging in any policy activity like this.
I want to jump to a segment called Emerging Tech for Emerging Leaders. Can you share any new and emerging technologies you think up-and-coming leaders of today and tomorrow need to know about?
I am happy to recommend a plugin that I think anybody who is worried about kind of their online security footprint should be using. It's called Privacy Party. It is developed by Tracy Chow, which does a checkup of all of your social profiles and says, highlights, here are the things that you might want to change, and does them for you, which makes it really easy. You don't have to kind of screw around with the settings on your account and look for things that the platforms don't want you to see. It brings it all right up there to the front. So that is something I would look at if you're worried about your digital security footprint.
And so what is the role of alliance building in technology policy?
Oh, gosh, I wish we did better with alliances and technology policy. I often feel like we are either working directly at odds with or kind of racing against, in particular, the EU. I think especially given the U.S. relationship with freedom of expression, it's often hard to find overlap with our allies on what we think tech policy should look like. But I am cognizant that the more we come together in that space, the greater our effect will be. But if we all did it together, it could be such a powerful message. And we just have not been able to do that yet. So I'd love to see more of that, you know, an alliance of democracies that is dealing with tech issues. I think that that could be very effective indeed.
Where do you see technology power and informational contest going in 2024?
I think with all of the elections that are on the docket this year, we are going to continue to see interference and influence campaigns, not only from the big three, but certainly from smaller nations as well, because the playbook has been opened for anybody who wants to do it. And I think we're going to see, especially with the introduction of democratized large language models, the ability to influence in a local language without detection, because it was usually those kind of idiosyncratic linguistic slip-ups that allowed us to identify Chinese or Russian or Iranian disinformation. It's not going to happen anymore, right? So it's so much easier. And it's not just about elections. It goes beyond elections. And like we were talking about before with Ukraine, kind of policy outcomes. So I think we're going to see a lot more of that in 2024 and beyond.
Coming up is Eyes and Ears. What have you been reading, listening to, or watching lately that might be of interest to our audience?
I've got a big stack of books on civil resistance that I'm working my way through, and that's why I'm reading Power of the Powerless by Václav Havel, which I read in graduate school and haven't revisited in a while. I am thinking about my third book and ways that civil resistance and kind of the concept of civil resistance can be applied for the digital polarized vitriolic age. So that's kind of my work reading right now. In terms of fun reading, well, watching, my guilty pleasure is I can't believe I'm admitting this, is All Creatures Great and Small. It's a British series, used to be a book too before it was a TV series. This is the revival. It's on Masterpiece Theatre. And it's about a vet in the Yorkshire Dales in the 30s and 40s. I just love it.
I was going to ask what you do in your downtime to keep sane, and now I know.
God, I don't have a lot of downtime yet. My baby is kind of in the throes of entering the terrible twos. They're just like constantly trying to kill themselves, but they're at least cute while they do it.
Yeah, we're a great advertisement for kids. My final segment is Need to Know. Is there anything I didn't ask that would have been great to cover?
Oh, gosh, no. Mia, it was a delight to talk to you.
Thanks for listening to Technology and Security. I've been your host, Dr. Mia Hamandari. If there was a moment you enjoyed today or a question you have about the show, feel free to tweet me at
MIAH_HE, or send an email to the address in the show notes. You can find out more about the work we do on our website, also linked in the show notes. We hope you enjoy this episode, and we'll see you soon.